I'm Gab, he's Jules. But Jules, we're doing something a little bit different.
Yeah.
This is Gab and Jules Meets, where we're going to go and hopefully speak to people who we think are interesting in football with different angles. And our first guest, his mom was a chef. His grandfather was a Michelin-starred chef. But he's here not just to talk about food, but football as well.
My name is Vittorio Montaliani. I got to make my mom happy. And I am the vice president of FIFA and the president of CONCACAF.
Football, maybe in Canada at the time when Victor was growing up, was not this big sport. There was all the American sports and everything, ice hockey, everything you want. But football was such a big part in his life. Played for Columbus FC, played for Canada Futsal, was very much involved in the game.
It's a story of football in North America, I think. Mm. In the immigrant communities, which obviously he was a part of, it is a really, really big deal still. But he always had that link back to Europe and to the continent. In fact, his dad was a big Inter fan, so much so that his brother's name is, well, Victor, what is your brother's name?
My dad named my brother Mario Mazzola. That's my brother's middle name. So I'm not sure I could run away from football when your youngest brother's middle name is Mazzola.
So at one point, Jules, because he has a day job, he's involved in insurance, but he also has a football background, he was asked to run for the presidency of the Canadian Federation, and he quickly implemented some changes.
What we did is we immediately, I guess, professionalized the organization in many, many ways. I knew, for instance, one of the things that drives professionalism in our sport is events, because the whole country can wrap their head around that, especially in North America, very event-driven society. So we bid for the Women's World Cup, we got it. We bid for the under 20 women, we got it. And then we launched the bid for the Men's World Cup and we got that too.
It's quite brave to take over the Canadian Federation when you know that at the time, I think they qualified for the 1986 World Cup, but that's pretty much it. So it's not like if it was an upcoming with great talent, great structure, etc. And yet, Victor always thought there was something to be done there. A great job was on the horizon.
You know, a lot of people thought I was even a little bit out of my mind. I remember when I first said as the president of Canadian Soccer, we're going to bid for the World Cup, the Men's World Cup. And I remember one of the prominent papers in Toronto said, this guy's out of his mind, literally. Well, we're hosting it now, right? So, I always felt, I always believed, listen, at the end of the day, football is always about players. I always believed that we had the talent. I always believed what we had, the players on both sides, men and women. And we just had to support them a lot better, which we have. Listen, you know, football is about results. We see a lot of talented teams that don't do what they need to do, you know, like your French team at the Euros.
Oh, Jules. My God. We're 5 minutes in and already you could have said, you know, Italy at the last World Cup, you know.
Sorry. But as you know, I think it's one thing not getting results because that's football, but it's another thing not reaching your potential on a consistent basis. Mm. And there's no reason why this country, that's a G7 country, can't reach its potential in this sport, in both men and women. And I think we're starting, I think we've gotten there on the women's side, and I think we're not far away from the men's side.
So Jules, the year is 2015, and FIFA is an absolute meltdown. There's a Don Ray and the Borolac Hotel and everything. And essentially, he's the head of the Canadian Association. Mm-hmm. One of the confederations are in the midst of this is CONCACAF. In fact, it is what set the wheels in motion as far as the FBI. You remember a man named Chuck Blazer, who was the general secretary of CONCACAF, and he was American. As we now know, I mean, he's now passed, but he was in the thick of it for many, many years, enabling Jack Warner and other figures. He ended up, the FBI said, you need to wear a wire and expose people. And that's what happened. So this is the reality of CONCACAF. And I remember I asked him flat out, because I spoke to him after he became CONCACAF president. I said, dude, the last four people who had your job are all either in prison or indicted or whatever.
Yeah.
Why are you doing this?
Why going there?
At the end of the day, my you know, besides the DNA of my family, mine is football, and it's always been football. And I felt that this confederation always had a lot of potential. If we could get it away from the small P politics that always existed in this confederation, and shifted it where everybody thought as one. And that's why my motto when I ran was one CONCACAF, not seven in Central America, 31 in the Caribbean, and three in the North, which was always CONCACAF. And the previous leaders you mentioned always kind of use that division for their own purposes. I said, it's one CONCACAF, one, right? 41 realities, one truth. And the one truth has to be football.
So you've started at club level. You did a great job. Yeah. Then you went federation level. You did a great job. Then you went confederation level. You're doing a great job. You did a great job. You know where I'm coming. So surely the natural next step at some point, and you know, I know that Gab one day will be the president of the FA here in England. Would you want to be FIFA president one day? Is that something, or do you think that you would rather focus on your region and making that region the best possible and making everybody happy or as much as you can? Or do you think that one day you would want to make the final step in this incredible progression?
I thought you were going to say, you know, and then the next step is Gab, Jules, and Montagliani.
Oh, my God. I would watch that. I would watch that.
And we have a worldwide syndication. My focus has always been on my confederation. I do everything I can as a FIFA vice president, especially my chair stakeholders. I have an excellent relationship with all the stakeholders. Most of them are the European. Great dialogue. It's a very candid relationship. I pride myself on that. But, you know, at the end of the day, like anything in football, I think it's always a team approach. The FIFA president has my support. Just like my other vice presidents have my support. So we might disagree on things. We might even tell each other to F off once in a while, but that's okay. I think I told my brother Mario to F off more than anybody in the world, but he's still my brother. And so, I think for me, the focus is CONCACAF. I think this region has tremendous potential. With a World Cup in our backyard, it would be irresponsible of me to even think about anything else than CONCACAF.
Gab, you know him really well. You've known him for a long time. And do you think he's got... could you see him becoming the FIFA boss? And two, do you think that even if he didn't really say, he's got it somewhere in the back of his mind?
I know, it's an interesting one. I think what makes him really well-suited to his job is, you know, you're thinking of CONCACAF, and it is such a disparate confederation, because you've got all the Caribbean nations who have a certain reality. You've got the seven Central American countries who have a very different reality. Yeah. You've got two massive countries, football-wise, like the U.S. and Mexico, who have the money and the culture. And being Canadian, he can kind of straddle the three things.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. And he cares a lot. You can tell he cares so much about the whole region.
I think one of the difficulties, and look, it's not a coincidence that the last two FIFA presidents have both been Swiss, is that, you know, I think the FIFA presidency is one of mediation, right?
Yeah.
So whether it's Blatter or Infantino, you know, they're seen as people who come from, who are neutral, who can speak and get the six confederations to work together, can speak to the rest of the world. That's how they got elected. In Blatter's case, certainly, it's also probably what led to some very bad things happening as well. It's not a coincidence, I think, that Infantino, even though he was a UEFA guy, you know, he was general secretary of UEFA, then his relationship with UEFA now isn't great, right? Because he immediately distanced himself from it. He said, oh, I need to go and represent CAF, I need to represent Asia, whatever. So I think he does have the skill set to be the guy who's kind of neutral, who's kind of above the fray. But I don't know whether, you know, he's got bigger fish to fry, certainly with the 2026 World Cup. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. So one of the biggest stories FIFA-wise, Jules, has been your boy Arsene Wenger.
Of course, of course.
And his proposals to reshape football. We should point out why this is coming now.
Yeah.
Is that there is a master document called the International Match Calendar and the Memorandum of Understanding, which everybody in football is signed to. And basically, this is the document. These are the rules that say you have to avoid chaos. This is what we're going to play. This is when we're going to play it for the next 10 years. Governs international breaks, league play, and so on. That is expiring in 2024. So they need to reach an agreement. So if you're going to reshape the game, the time is now. And the clock is ticking because they need to do this pretty quickly. So Arsene Wenger came up with his proposal, and everybody focused on what?
The World Cup every 2 years.
It's not the only part of his proposal, but that is the part that everybody looked at. The other part also involves mandatory rest periods, reducing the number of internationals, and reducing the number of international breaks.
Yeah.
This is going to be voted on by FIFA members. Some confederations, UEFA and South America, already coming out strongly against them. The thinking was that, hey, everybody's going to vote in favor of this because FIFA make money from World Cups, and that's money that gets redistributed to the nations. I think Victor had a slightly more nuanced view on this, on the entire plan.
Everybody's focusing on one thing, right? A two-year World Cup. You know, whereas there's a whole menu of things here that we need to discuss. Primarily the calendar. You know, everything's underpinned by a proper calendar. You know, and the two-year World Cup, we've given our feedback to FIFA. We've given them, you know, these are the questions we need to answer. How does that affect the ecosystem that we currently have in our confederation? Because, you know, a lot of things we didn't have 5 years ago in CONCACAF, but now we have them, right? Nations League, a more robust Gold Cup, a more robust Champions League. How does that affect our ecosystem? I'm not going to scream at the top of my lungs to say, you know, it's the worst idea in the history of man. I just want to know. I just need to know this information. And to be honest with you, these are discussions we've had even along the way. We used to have a Confederations Cup, got pulled away. Confederations Cup was a big deal in my confederation because it gave something to the winner of the Gold Cup to go to. You know, we even had discussions 5 years ago about a global nations league. You know, some of the confederations around the table. And that kind of died down, but you know, some of those principles, you know, were well worth discussing. So I think the principle of having something between the current World Cup cycles that is a national team event, that is a FIFA event, whatever you want to call it, I think that principle, I'm not sure too many people around the table would reject that. He laid out an idea and, you know, he was clear to say, these are my ideas. If you have other ideas, please share them with me. And it's one thing to say you don't agree with his ideas, and there's some that I don't agree with, absolutely. But it's something to just sit there and just say you don't agree with it, but not also sort of invest in the dialogue, because I think as a sport, we need to invest in the dialogue. Some of it has to be disruptive as well, because disruptive dialogue is always good. And the sport has a history of that. I mean, look, we used to have no substitutes in the game of football. Then we went to one, then we went to three, and now it took a pandemic to get to five, right? That's how slow football moves. The game needs to evolve. We need to have these dialogues. You know, we've been clear with FIFA. We not only said, listen, you know, the principles of dialogue and the principles that they're trying to change, I think I have no issues with. Do I have issues with certain things? I'll give an example, a specific example. On the whole calendar with the 7 matches in 1 month, for us at CONCACAF, that's going to be problematic. One, because 1 month doesn't work. It needs to be spread out a little bit more. And also, you know, right now the member associations have 10 matches a year that their national team can play. Going to seven is a reduction of 30% on your inventory. Can you tell me any other stakeholder in football that is reducing their inventory by 30%? It's absolute, for me, that's a non-starter. Now, reducing the windows that those 10 matches are played, that's a different story, because that then hits on the issue of less travel for the players, mandatory rest period. I'm all for that. And some of the concerns that have been brought forward by a lot of my peers and colleagues are absolutely valid. But I don't feel, anyway, that FIFA has rejected those concerns. In fact, I've heard not only Arsene, but I've heard the president say, hey, listen, I'm not here to force anything down anybody's throat. I have my opinion, but I need to hear from my members. And I think some members have spoken louder than others. Fair enough. But I think everybody is starting to have their turn, including the stakeholders, clubs, leagues, whatever.
So this is actually one of the big things that Gianni Infantino has been talking about since he was elected, right? Sort of the whole economics of football. Football's the number one sport in the world.
Yeah.
It's the number one sport in almost every region of the world. There are rich people all over the world, but rich people in Asia and in North America, which is where, you know, a lot of the world's wealth is, by and large, many of them choose to invest in Europe and in the European club game. So the money is all flowing there.
Yeah.
I mean, is this...
This is not sustainable, really. And I think if you're head of a confederation like CONCACAF, where you're...
And a FIFA vice president.
FIFA vice president as well, one of your priorities has to find a way of getting those resources more diverse, given to different areas in the world. I think you see the expansion of MLS, for example, which Victor has overseen already. Would it be good for him to merge, for example, the Mexican League and MLS? You know, all those kind of stuff. This has to be part of the conversation. And what do you do with tournaments? What do you do with money prizes? All of that is a big thing.
Yeah, no, I kind of feel that people are going to look out for their area of the world, and rightly so. Mm. So UEFA looks out for its European members.
Yeah.
Equally, if you're in Asia or if you're in North America, you're going to say, or in CONCACAF, you're going to say, hang on a minute, Glazers, Kroenkes, etc. How about you spend some money over here? How about you help push the development here? Yeah. I think it's very fair that these people go and push the side of it, and then you have a conversation, and then you sort it out.
I think for a lot of confederations, and a lot of member associations, actually more than confederations, for a lot of member associations, if there isn't a strong FIFA, there will be a lot more suffering. Because they would just, you know, be eaten up by the game, by the economics of the game. And so, you know, with all due respect, it was no different than why people went crazy about the Super League, because it was destroying national team football. Well, what's the difference between that concept and a concept of an entire continent or two taken off into rocket space and everybody's sitting there going, well, how am I supposed to compete with that? The reality of the market is that, you know, where all the money is kind of going to, whether it's, you know, American money, Asian money, wherever money, it's gonna go where, you know, it's gonna get its return on investment, and I can appreciate that. Now, you know, here at CONCACAF, we're lucky because we have a big market. We've been able to make some strides. I mean, just in the time that I've walked through the door the last 5 years, we've increased the amount of games we've played, you know, by over 2,000 games. Right. And that's all our members. And that's great. That's more football. That's what they need, whether it's Nations League or club football, whatever. But that's not a reality in a lot of confederations. Right. And so how do we help that? How do we sort of nurture that? The materials that are required for top level football, as you know, players and coaches, they come from all over the world. Right. And these clubs that you just mentioned, their assets are multinational. They're not European players or English players, let's say, you know, in EPL, they're players from all over the world. So I think it behooves us to take care of global football, to nurture these talents, to nurture the game so that, you know, everybody, you know, players will always find their way to the best league in the world. And that I have no issues with that. But we can't also neglect where these players are coming from and the countries they're coming from we have to find a way that we don't leave them behind and we do the proper thing. Because when FIFA generates revenue, it's a there's a global distribution. You know, with all due respect, when a league gets their pot of money, like is about to happen here in the U.S. with the rights that are up, does U.S. soccer get any of that? Do the grassroots clubs get any of that? Right? And then what happens to the market for a domestic league? People were going crazy about the Super League, about the domestic market. How about the domestic league here in the U.S.? When you take all the oxygen out of the room, what's left for the domestic market?
And of course, we also had to ask Victor about the Super League and those changes that something like the Super League or could the effect that could have on football overall. And a lot of people were against the Super League. Victor has a very interesting point of view on the question.
We supported UEFA in sort of how what they needed to do. But I also think each jurisdiction needs to look after what they think is the best interest. So on the topic of Super League, there's some areas in the world I think it's a great idea. because you don't have 100 and plus years history of a domestic league. I totally understand why there was this backlash in Europe and by UEFA, just because of the traditional way that football has always been. Obviously, a European background, you know, I know what a Scudetto means, right? And so, you know, I totally get that. But in a lot of parts of the world, I can tell you that the concept of, you know, I hate to use the word Super League, but the concept of leagues, of a regional league, or a continental league might actually be the ticket for the development of club football in some parts of the world. You know,
well, you have that in North America, right? I mean, you have three Canadian clubs, right?
Yeah.
In MLS.
You have that. It's cross-border, yes. But also, you know, there's been talk even here in my confederation in Central America that I think is ripe for something like that. I think they're even studying it because you have, you know, seven countries that are geographically close. You have some really good clubs that have done well in the Champions League. Is there a way where you can bring that all together on a weekly basis and figure out a system underneath that that doesn't necessarily kill the domestic league, but helps it understand what the cadence is here? So there's parts of the world where I think it could happen. So, you know, I don't think the idea should be just thrown. You can't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
One of the FIFA priorities after Infantino was elected was to set up a FIFA stakeholder committee,
yeah.
Which Victor's actually the vice president of it. Anyway, he's the vice president of FIFA, obviously, but he's in charge of the stakeholder committee. And they were going to look at problems locally and what we can search, people can agree on. In some ways, the first thing that they're dealing with, or the thing they were able to push through quickest, is regulating agents.
Yeah.
You and I, we talk to agents a lot. We talk to clubs a lot. I think we can both agree that some regulation is needed, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think when we look at some, and there's some even stories that have never come out, and some of the things that agents are involved in. One of your big thing is that you shouldn't have the same agent for players and managers, for example, or same even windows for manager and players, all those sort of things. There's so much to go through, and Victor has, I think, great ideas around it. And himself talks to agent, by the way.
Yeah, no, which is part of the job. And I think it's part of part of the reason this hasn't been necessarily implemented as quickly as some people would have liked. But even basic steps, some of the early proposals about saying, oh, look, if you're an agent, you can't represent the selling club, the buying club, and the player in the same transaction. And when we talk agents, let's make it clear. People may not understand this from North America, right? We're not talking, you know, in North American sports, agents represent players.
That's
right?
It.
They don't get paid commissions when somebody gets traded.
No.
So for all the talk that people, like the guy in the NBA, whose name escapes me right now, represents... Rich Paul. He does it when he gets paid by the people he represents. He doesn't then take money from the clubs.
No.
That's not how it works in football. And it's very dysfunctional. That is one of the things that they're trying to work on.
Yeah.
I don't agree with all of it. I don't necessarily agree with a cap in commissions. I just rather see more transparency. I think if you want to pay somebody $100 million, you should be free to do so. But let's let Victor explain where they are.
When it comes to agents of any profession that I know of, mortgages, real estate, there is governance on agents. So if we're able to govern people that sell dirt and land, how the hell can we not regulate people that trade human beings? Like, with all due respect, you know, because that's what you're doing. You're taking this player from that club to this club, right? And so how are we not regulating that? Regulating means, do you have the proper licensing? Do you have continuing education? Are the players being protected in the right way? So it's not just everybody's, again, looking at the cap. There's a lot in there from a regulatory standpoint that is very good and is good practice. And quite frankly, many, many sports industries have it, right? Many sports industries have it. And as we know here, and there's no reason why football shouldn't have it, okay? Now, the cap, you know, should it be discussed? I'm more than willing to discuss it. But, you know, multiple representation representing, I mean, listen, you know, representing, I just don't know how that works when you represent. It's not common sense.
The coach and the sporting director and the player.
It doesn't make sense, right? So, you know, and also, you know, some of the things we have is a clearinghouse, right? So we've instituted a clearinghouse because, you know, our fans have the right to know what these transactions are, right? And so we've instituted a clearinghouse. One of the things I think that clearinghouse will do is, again, bring back some regulatory thing where the people in the industry, whether it's club, league, agent, player, that these things have to be done in a proper way before transfers are signed off. I mean, it's no different than any other financial transaction that I'm used to in the corporate world. You know, if I don't do what I need to do, you think the bank's going to lend me money? No chance.
But, well, right? No, it just kind of feels like this is something that all stakeholders, except perhaps agents, agree on, and yet it seems to be a slow burn.
It is a slow burn, and I think, you know, I think other things have kind of jumped in a little bit, and it is a slow burn. There's some stakeholders that want it more than others. Obviously, the agents probably being the least, but not all agents, I have to say that. I mean, honestly, there's been some good dialogue. Reasonable people, they understand the principles of what we're trying to do. They might not agree with a number, but I think the principles of governance, I'm not, unless you're a real cowboy, I think the principles of governance, most agents probably welcome it.
I have a secret.
Uh-huh.
I use Secret Whole Body Deodorant because more than just my armpits stink.
Oh, can I use it where my bra rubs under my...
Oh, yeah.
And what about down there? You know, my...
Totally. 4 out of 5 gynecologists would recommend it. So I tried it, and now I get 72 hours of freshness from my pits to my...
Ooh, I love that it's a spray.
Me too. And it comes in sticks and creams too. Go get your Secret Whole Body Deodorant.
Obviously, for Victor in his confederation, Gab, as we mentioned before, there's two big giants in MLS and Liga MX, Mexico and the US. And for years and years and years now, there have been discussions of what if we merge them two and have a huge league, basically, with Mexican clubs, American clubs, some Canadian clubs as well, that who are already in MLS.
You can't be leaving out Canada.
No,
you can't
leave
with Victor.
And of course, we had to ask Victor what he makes of all of this.
You know, there's enough talk about it. I think both. I mean, they have this League's Cup that we actually was just a bunch of really friendlies. We've now incorporated that into our Champions League. So that League's Cup between Liga MX and MLS will be the group stage in North America because we've regionalized our group stage. So we're cognizant that the way of the future is you got to think outside the box. I could take some of the best practices from, you know, what I think is the top, you know, sort of region in the world, which is Europe. I could take a lot of the best practices, but I also have to be cognizant that some of the stuff that works there is not going to work in my region. you know, we have a different culture. We have a different thing. This is why our Champions League that we announced recently is a completely different format. It's all knockout, right? And because in North America, as you know, Gabe, the consumer loves that stuff. I mean, one of the biggest months in sport is the NCAA, you know, tournament. 64 teams, March Madness, knockout. People love that here. Now, you know, I don't know if that would, I don't know if that would work in other parts of the world, but here people love that. And so when we have, so our Champions League is literally, we have a complete knockout stage to get to the final 24 teams and then another knockout stage. People are going to, like, I know that will resonate with our customer base here.
Victor has also been a pioneer years ago about women's football and developing women's football in North America, but also in the world. And I think it was very important for him to do so, recognize the potential that the sport had for his confederation and for his FA at the time, and all the work that they've been doing all those years since.
But we are focusing a lot on the development side because, you know, let's be honest, I have a gold medal country and I got world champions, right? And then the disparity between those two and the next tier is pretty big. And then the next tier and the last tier is really enormous. And so, you know, the reality is that the discrepancies are too big. We have to shorten them. We have a league here in North America. It's a very good league. We have leagues in Europe, very good leagues. A lot of the top players in the world play on both sides of the ocean. But that's not the reality of women's football globally, and it's not even a reality in my region, right? The reality is that I need to increase the participation of women in more countries and give them opportunities, whether it's not even just to play professionally, but also to access scholarships. And a lot of women's development is not driven at club level globally, right? It's driven by national teams. In fact, a lot of the national teams in the world are club teams, because they have a big pool of players, they play tournaments, and that's the reality for most countries in the world.
Yeah, so Jules, I also asked them about, and this kind of really is one of my bugbears, it's this idea that the priority for the women's game should be, oh, it needs to be professional, they need to have big prize money, blah, blah, blah. I think the goal should be making it so that the greatest number of women can play the game.
Yeah.
If then that's a semi-pro, and if they can play the game with guarantees in terms of maternity leave, in terms of healthcare, and so on. If then that means that, you know, they can also be professional, that's great.
Yeah.
But to me, the priority should be expanding the base, because what we're seeing now is that it's the rich countries who have the most women playing football who dominate these events. There's a perfect correlation between GDP and success of the women's game.
No, Gabe, listen, I can tell you as a confederation president, sure, you know, obviously we have elite competitions and those are important. We need to qualify our best teams to these, whether it's a World Cup or an Olympics. Absolutely, no problem. But I can tell you, I would say that 90% of my time and my staff's time is not spent at the elite level and thinking about the elite level. It's spent with the other 38 member associations. And how do we get more girls on a pitch? How do we get more girls involved in a game? How do we create what I call consumers of football who will go on to God knows what, whether it be a higher level of play, administration, executives, whatever. So for us, our W strategy, you know, the tag was we belong. Having more girls in Panama play, having more girls in St. Vincent play, having more girls in Aruba play, and having those federations have robust women's programs, you know, from the grassroots right up to elite, whatever they define as elite, right? Obviously, it's relative. But And it doesn't mean Aruba is going to compete with the United States in 5 years' time or 20 years' time or, quite frankly, 100 years' time. That's not what we're talking about. So that is the reality that we're facing in our confederation more on a daily basis than figuring out what's happening at the elite level.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Victor spoke about this, the generation that is coming through for both men and women. Of course, there's one player that is maybe more, no offense, Jonathan David, but one that is more outstanding than all the others. It's Alfonso Davies. So we had to ask Victor, really, about Alfonso Davies.
Who?
Alfonso is someone.
So here's the story. The first time I ever heard his name, he was not at the Vancouver Whitecaps. It was the opening match of the Women's World Cup 2015, Canada-China, and it was the night before. I invited one of my best friends. He was a scout for the Whitecaps, a guy by the name of Frank Chacha. Frank and I are lifelong friends. In fact, our parents are actually from the same paese in Italy, ironically. He was a national team player, fantastic player himself. So he was a scout for the Whitecaps and handled all that for them. And he calls me the night before the first game of the Women's World Cup and says, "Hey, Vic, thanks for the invitation," because he was in Alberta, where Edmonton is. He goes, "I can't come." I go, "Oh, no problem." He goes, "I got to go see this player. They say he's a phenom." I go, "Okay, all right, no problem. Who is this guy?" He goes, "Alfonso Davies." "Okay, whatever, right?" So, okay, see ya. So he calls me after the women's game and he goes, "Hey, great result. We had beat 1-0 in the first game of the Women's World Cup." I say, "By the way, how was that player?" He goes, "Just remember this name." I go, "Alfonso Davies." I go, "Why?" He goes, "I have never seen any player ever at that age have that ability." Now, you know, we've heard that story many times for other players. He says, "But this kid's different. Just remember that name." That was June of 2015.
Wow.
He then takes him from this amateur club in Edmonton to the Whitecaps. He spends 5 minutes in the academy, and then he goes to the first team, and then the rest is history. But that's the first time I heard Alfonso.
Amazing.
And, you know, I'm not sure many know that story, but I think Frank should get a shout out. I know Alfonso appreciates it, but, you know, it's obviously, you know, as much as obviously his journey, he's been developed all the way along the way, including at Bayern. But, you know, the football gods have shone on Alfonso in terms of his talent. And, you know, he's obviously a very humble young man with, comes from a fantastic family and a fantastic story.
I got to ask this question now, right, Jules, because I had to ask him, because Canada are top of their group.
Incredible.
But it's been kind of counterintuitive the way they appointed their national team coach and who it is.
Yeah.
I didn't know who this dude was until very recently, because all the things that supposedly you don't want your national team coach to be, right? This is a guy who never played professionally.
Nope.
Who went to university.
Yep.
Who started, who's English, not just English, but Geordie.
Yeah, north of England.
Who started out coaching women.
Yeah.
He coached the New Zealand team. Then he came and coached the Canada women's team.
With a lot of success.
Yeah, and he had Christine Sinclair, of
course.
I know,
but still.
Christine Sinclair, for those who don't know, is the person whose record Cristiano Ronaldo will break when he retires in 2045. And then he applies to coach the men's team, and it works. Yeah. And these players who, you know, look, we can joke about Canada, but, you know, I think recently they had more players in the Champions League than the United States did, for example. Yeah. You know, they've got guys now who are playing at big European clubs. It's not just Davies and David. It's Kyle Larin. It's, you know, Atiba Hutchinson. So it's a lot of guys, right? I thought that's absolutely remarkable and counterintuitive. So I had to ask him about this John Herdman, who we both live in the United Kingdom. I bet very few people outside of his immediate family have ever heard of him.
First and foremost, yes, I did hire John. John actually interviewed for the job before, and then we hired Carolina Morace. He just wasn't ready, and he admits that. And then we brought John in before the Olympics in 2012. And yes, I hired him. My relationship with John is outstanding. We are close. In fact, when I had just left the Federation, when the opening came up in the men's side, and John, you know, I don't want to tell tales out of school, but John called me, and then he spent, after he got the appointment, he spent the first 4 to 5 hours of being a coach at my house. and we went through every player and he's done a great job. Listen, John, in terms of preparation and hard work, I'm not sure I've seen too many coaches do that. And he also knows, like, you know, and I don't know if every coach is like this, but he's got a very high EQ, right? So he understands the touch points of players. He also knows his weaknesses. And so he's brought people in to say, okay, that's not my forte. So guess what? You're coming in. And he's also grown as a coach. And these are things, you know, I'll keep those discussions between me and John, but where, you know, even in our discussions, identified maybe some areas of improvement that are required. And I've seen that growth in those areas of improvement, even just in the qualifying that started, I guess, at the beginning of the year. And so that's a mark of somebody that listens, right? And to me, John listens. And he's just a quality guy to start with, notwithstanding he's a Geordie, I guess. But he's a quality guy and a good family man. And he deserves all the success that I think is going to come to him. And I couldn't be happier for him.
Victor, you've been so generous with your time.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for being our inaugural guest on Gab and Jules Meets.
Thank you very much, guys. It's actually been a pleasure just to chit-chat. I felt like I was at a coffee shop, even though you haven't sent me a cappuccino yet, Kate. And as I said, remember that idea, right?
Yeah.
If you ever want to syndicate this thing, I'm in.
What a nice guy. What a lovely time we had listening to Victor.
I'm not 100% sure, though, about him joining us and turning him into Gab, Jules, and Montagliani show.
We should give him a chance. You know, always give a chance to the juniors who are looking up to us.
I don't know, though. He'd have to move to London. I don't know. I think he kind of likes it in Vancouver.
Oh, we move to Vancouver if you want. But it's cold. It's cold in the winter.
Yeah, cold winters. Not sure about that. Yeah. But, you know who his next-door neighbor is in Vancouver?
No.
It's Carlo Ancelotti.
Oh, my God. That's amazing. Imagine, like...
You didn't know about Victor.
Going to your local coffee shop, and then Carlo is there, and then you can have the loveless chat.
So we're going to try to do this regularly, as we said. We'll try to bring you players, coaches, people in around the game, agents, people who we think are interesting. We'll try to have a calmer chat with it. And we'll see where this goes. And
sounds great.
So if you want a pitch to be on the Gab and Jules Meet Show, please, you know where to find me.